This week marks 11 years since the Rwandan genocide. Since the atrocities ended, the country has remained relatively calm as the UN has slowly led the country through war crimes trials meant to bring both justice and healing. The highest-profile cases so far involved journalists, the first member of the media tried since Nuremberg. They were convicted of inciting the Hutu majority to slaughter their Tutsi countrymen. Author Dina Temple Raston interviewed many of the people involved for her new book, Justice on the Grass, three Rwandan journalists, their trial for war crimes, and a nation's quest for redemption. She joins us now from our bureau in New York City, and nice to have you on Talk of the Nation.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
If a listener has a question or comments about Rwanda in the years since the massacres or about the effectiveness and the impact of the trials, our phone number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Dina Temple Raston, in your book, you track about half a dozen ordinary Rwandans through the aftermath of the genocide. What did you learn from them about how people in that country have coped with this monstrous event?
Well, I think that there's been so many books that have focused solely on what the genocide itself happened during those 100 days in 1994. I just thought it was more interesting to take a look at the development of people since then. How do they forgive? Do they forgive? How do their lives go on once something like this happens to them? And that's why I decided to just do several very individual stories instead of something more broad.
Well, I was particularly interested in the story you told of a man falsely convicted of participating in the genocide. What was his story?
Well, Damien was the assistant director of an orphanage in Kigali. And after President Habyarimana's plane went down, which is about 11 years ago yesterday, the genocide sparked, and he was worried that these Tutsi children who were under his care were going to be hurt in some way. So he thought it was just a coup and that maybe it was just in Kigali. So he stole a bus, loaded these 40 children on the bus, and then drove them to a town called Butare. Eventually, he was actually accused of killing these children, and he was sent to jail for 8 years, and finally had a trial after those 8 years in which he was completely exonerated. And the way he was exonerated was by a judge simply saying, "Explain something to me. Why would this man have risked his life to drive these children to Butare only to kill them there?" And that's what got him off.
And was there restitution? Was there an apology? Did he get his job back?
All those questions are good ones, and all the answers are no. He didn't get anything except the government saying, "You've been found innocent. Now you can go back home." Of course, his home was no longer there 8 years later. He had a a child that was about 8 and a half by the time he got out, hardly knew her, and had no job. And and Damien is emblematic of a lot of things that are going on in Rwanda now.
Is he a bitter man?
No, surprisingly. He's actually one of the heroes in the book because he didn't have any bitterness. And the last time I spoke to him was just before the elections, the multi-party elections in Rwanda in 2004. And he had said to me that he was going to vote for Kagame because the Hutu had had their chance to rule, and now it was time to give the Tutsi a turn.
Tell us a little bit about the title of your book, Justice on the Grass. What does that mean?
In Kinyarwanda, the term gachacha means justice on the grass. And gachacha was a special tribal court that they resurrected in Rwanda in order to take care of all the people who had been accused of crimes in Rwanda during the genocide but had not been tried. Over 120,000 people went into the Rwandan prisons, and they were sent there simply by having a neighbor or someone point them out and say, he was involved with the genocide. There was no investigation. There was no sort of folder on these people. Mm-hmm. So they decided the only way to get them out of prison without declaring an overall amnesty, which President Kagame didn't want to do, was to bring them into these gachacha courts and have the communities deal with them one by one.
So this is a long way away from a war crimes tribunals in The Hague.
Yes, or war crime tribunal in Arusha, Tanzania, which is where these three journalists were tried. Mm-hmm. I was trying to take a look at the different types of justice systems that Rwanda tried to use to try and bring everybody back together again.
I wondered, in Africa, of course, there was the example in South Africa of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which drew a lot of criticism but also drew a lot of praise for helping bring that country together with a minimum of bloodshed at the end of the apartheid regime. Was that an approach that was considered in Rwanda?
Well, actually, the Gacaca system was sort of a lesser cousin of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And Truth and Reconciliation, I think at this point, most people think that it was probably a good thing. Before they would go into communities in South Africa for Truth and Reconciliation hearings, they would actually prepare the community and have psychologists come in and have them talk about apartheid. So they were really ready to discuss this on a platform when the Truth and Reconciliation Committee came to town. In Rwanda, they didn't do that at all. In fact, people are required to do Gacaca and are required to attend. And for reconciliation purposes, one of the things that is more difficult about that is that Tutsi crimes are not allowed to be discussed in Gacaca. So, in other words, the only people who are really on trial in these communities are Hutu, and this just drives a bigger wedge between the two groups.
So are these trials, you say they're driving a bigger wedge, so these trials are not having the effect of reconciliation at all?
Not at all, not at all. I don't think you can really find anyone who, besides President Kagame, who thinks these things are working.
Given that, are people beginning to seek some justice on their own, some vengeance?
There have been a lot of reprisal killings against Hutu, mostly in the Congo, by Rwandan Patriotic Front Army, which is largely Tutsi. And the thing is that when we heard about Rwanda, we thought that this was tribal infighting. I was a White House correspondent at that time, and I remember that was the discussion in the White House. The truth is, Hutu and Tutsi are not two different tribes. They're descendants of the same ancestors, and they have the same religion, they have the same language, they intermarry. Hutu is actually a word that means slave in Kinyarwanda. So it was really a caste system. And it was a caste system that was developed by the Belgians in the 1900s. They basically didn't want to administer Rwanda. They didn't want to use Belgian resources. So they put the Tutsi in charge as a divide-and-conquer idea, and then handed out cards and said, okay, how thin is your nose? Oh, if your nose is thin, then you are Tutsi. What color is your skin? Oh, if your skin's dark, we deem you a Hutu. And by issuing these cards, they basically codified a system that really didn't exist before they got there. And if you've seen Hotel Rwanda or sometimes in April, you'll see when people go to the roadblocks where they were often killed during the genocide, they were asked for their identity cards. It was these cards that the Belgians gave them, this artificial sort of construct that led to the death of many Tutsi.
We're talking with Dina Temple-Raston, the author of the new book, Justice on the Grass, Three Rwandan Journalists, Their Trial for War Crimes, and A Nation's Quest for Redemption. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. And let's get a call in from Eric, who's calling from Newark, Delaware.
Hi, I'm calling from the University of Delaware. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
We're actually studying the Rwanda genocide right now. Two quick questions. Number one, the Rwanda genocide is very similar to what happened to the Jews in Nazi Germany. So why isn't the world paying more attention to these trials? And number two, could the United States, if it had wanted to do more, could have done more? Because as your guest is saying, she was a White House correspondent, the administration even forbid the word genocide to be used. Thanks for taking my call.
Okay, Eric, thank you.
Yeah, I remember actually when there was this debate about whether or not to use the word genocide when the killing started in Rwanda. There are a couple things that you have to remember. First of all, the Rwandan genocide only lasted 100 days. 800,000 people were killed, but it was only 100 days. And the second thing that's key to remember is that it came 6 months after the events in Mogadishu, in which the helicopter Black Hawk Down were shot down and those soldiers were dragged behind trucks in Mogadishu. So there was absolutely no political appetite for the U.S. to get involved. I'm not saying they should or shouldn't have. I'm just saying that the reality of the situation at that very moment made it impossible to do so.
The United States, of course, was the one country, I guess, in the world, possible exception of Britain or France, with the military capabilities, the logistical capabilities of moving any kind of force into that country in the time available.
I'm not even sure that that a big force would have been necessary. If you talk to experts about genocide, they would say that really all they needed was a token resistance force, and it would have stopped the genocide from spiraling the way it did. In fact, one person said it would have taken the equivalent of the Brooklyn police force to stop it.
The book focuses, as the title suggests, on the war crimes trials against three Rwandan journalists. Tell us a little bit about them. What was their role? How does journalism become equated with war crimes?
Well, they were three of the founders of a radio station called Radio Mille Collines, or RTLM. And if you've seen these recent movies on Rwanda, there's a radio station that sort of plays a cameo role in both of them, in which they're sort of telling people to go out and kill Tutsi and basically whipping them up into a frenzy. And that radio station was RTLM. It was the first private radio station in Rwanda, and it started out as just being critical of a power-sharing agreement that the UN was trying to forge called the Arusha Accords. And then as things went on, it kept on sort of wondering whether there were Tutsi accomplices that were in the villages. Could you trust the Tutsi who were next to you? And then after President Habyarimana's plane was shot down and the genocide started, it became almost a military communication system in which it would say the Tutsi are hiding in the mosque or the Tutsi are in the cultural center and, you know, you must do your work, you must go and kill them.
And not just this radio station, but a newspaper, which you compare to Der Stürmer, the vile Nazi publication.
Yes, the caller had talked about the Holocaust, and there are some amazing parallels between the two, between what happened in Rwanda and what happened during the Holocaust. And in this case, if you take a look at Kangura, which was this newspaper that Hassan Ngezi had started, and you take a look at Der Stürmer, they look like almost exactly alike. Clearly, they're in different languages, but the way the headlines are placed, or the way the photographs are placed, or even the tone of the articles, it was anti-Semitic in Der Stürmer's case, and it was anti-Tutsi in the case of Kangura.
Dina Temple-Raston is the author of Justice on the Grass, Three Rwandan Journalists, Their Trial for War Crimes, and A Nation's Quest for Redemption. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. But the trial of these journalists raises some disturbing questions about the line between even reprehensible journalism, broadcasting, and genocide.
Yes, and where the lines of protected speech go. You started out by talking about how these are the first three journalists to have been brought up on these kinds of trials since Julius Strischer in Nuremberg. And what interested me about this is because we really haven't had an international court take a look at what is permissible and what's not in journalism for, you know, since 1945. Mm-hmm. So the thing that was interesting about this particular case was that these three journalists were really the only people who were alive or could be found who were related to RTLM. And there was very little question that RTLM was bad and had whipped up the genocide. The question was, who were they going to hold responsible? And in order to hold these three men responsible, the judgment ended up being very broadly written because their voices never appeared or never came over the airwaves. The editorials in Kangura were mostly not signed, so you couldn't prove that Hassan Ngezi, one of the three journalists, had done it. So they ended up really writing a broad judgment that could affect journalists the world over.
Let's get some listeners back into the conversation. And this is Tuck. Tuck's calling from Westport, Connecticut.
Hello.
Hello. You're on the air, Tuck.
Thanks. This may be a little off the topic. I recently read a book by Jared Diamond called Collapse, where he talks about Rwanda as an example of a society which collapsed. And he said that the pressure behind the difficulties in Rwanda, besides genocide, was also an incredible pressure of overpopulation and too little land, which was the basis of the wealth. And that he pointed out that where Hutu and Tutsi were actually killing each other, even though one side was clearly more to blame than the other. And I'm wondering if your guest will comment on this.
Sure, yeah. The book goes to great pains to talk about how this really wasn't tribal infighting or ethnic conflict, but a power struggle. And the idea that the Hutu, people who were Hutu extremists decided that if you wiped out 15% of the population, that would be all the Tutsi, which is what they tried to do, then they would have more land for themselves. Rwanda is the most crowded country in Africa, and it's very hilly, like Costa Rica hilly. And so it's hard to farm there, and land is an enormous commodity, and there really is nothing else in terms of resources. There's tea and there's coffee, but it doesn't have diamonds or something that would make it easier for the people who live there.
Thanks, Tuck.
Thank you.
And go to Mary. Mary is calling from Cleveland.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering, what is the relationship between the two tribes now, and could this happen again? And I'll listen off the air.
Thanks, Mary.
That's a great question, actually. And I would say that actually the relationship between Hutu and Tutsi now is worse than it was before the genocide. They intermarried and they lived together well enough before the genocide. But now there's tremendous resentment. And this resentment is sort of piled on by things like Gacaca, in which Tutsi are not held responsible, or the fact that now the Tutsi rule Rwanda. President Kagame is a Tutsi. And they've done away with the identity cards. And now everyone is supposed to call each other Rwandans. But if you ask any Rwandan if they're Hutu or they're Tutsi, they will tell you immediately who they are.
And the other part of Mary's question, could it happen again?
Could it happen again? Well, all the building blocks of genocide haven't changed. Nothing's really changed except that there aren't any identity cards anymore. And I think that there'll be 800,000 people killed in 100 days? No, I don't. I don't think that can happen again. But do I think that there'll be tens of thousands killed and maybe we won't notice or we'll notice after the fact? Absolutely. I mean, there are a lot of resentful Hutu who are there now just sort of waiting for their opportunity. That's one of the reasons why the Rwandan Patriotic Army is going into the Congo again and again to try and bring down any remnants of the Hutu power movement.
And briefly, because we just have a few seconds left, are there any international forces still in Rwanda that the equivalent of the Brooklyn Police Force?
Minimally. So if something like that were to happen again, there really isn't a lightning force that can go back in there and stop it.
Dina Temple-Raston, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Dina Temple-Raston, a reporter with the New York Sun, author of Justice on the Grass, Three Rwandan Journalists, Their Trial for War Crimes, and A Nation's Quest for Redemption. She joined us from our bureau in New York. If you would like to see photographs and read Chapter 1 from Justice on the Grass, you can find it on our website at npr.org. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan.